Felix said he would take Azeb to the couch, and Oris obviously wanted me. He became abusive, so finally I took him to my room. He was not able to do much, for the wine had made him lustful, but had taken away his ability to perform. I was tempted to mock him, but he had been so critical of you, my lord, that I dared not, in fear that he would become more angry and abusive. Felix was unpleasant with Azeb, and struck her on the cheek, because she would not do what he asked, which would have been an unnatural act. Romulus, we need strong men here to guard us against soldiers like Felix and Oris. What does their change in demeanour mean? What has happened? My lord Romulus, you have just left me, but my heart is so full that I think it will burst from my body. You have told me to write everything down, so I shall. Everything. I have long thought that you cared especially for me, my lord. Now you have told me you do, and that you will take me with you when you return to Rome. I cannot believe that I am so lucky. Indeed, I am the happiest among women, for you do me an incredible admiration, and I am grateful to you for all that you do to keep me safe at this moment. I was so full of your love and feelings for me. Never has any man held me in such a prime place in his life. You came in, kissed my face and neck, fondled my breasts and then my rump, which you covered with both your hands, one hand to each side, which you stroked and kneaded into fire. You lifted my garment and pulled me onto you, as though my body were a natural twin to your own. So I felt your stiffness within me, pumping me so that I seemed to be enlarged by your loving male serpent. I shall not forget, my dearest one, how you took me from the wall, like a feather in your arms, and spread me upon my own bed. And with my garment rent open and my breasts rising toward you, I was taken, it seemed, into a seventh heaven of physical wonder. You, Romulus, deep within me, is all I can think of. It is so wondrous, and I found it difficult to satisfy you. My legs were open wide to receive you, yet I was forced to open them wider, and then wrap my legs around the trunk of your body. So we made the race together. You riding me and I depleting you of your prodigious seed, as you bucked and throbbed into me. Nor will I forget how we lay together, close and loving, so that you stroked me in the secret places of my body, kissed me on the mouth, and your tongue became a lithe, live part of you, as you thrust it into my mouth, just as you propel your sex into me, and make me cry out with longing for you. I wish to be able to feel you melt into my body and I into yours. I am raw with your great piercing pleasure. Yet I want you to impale me again and yet again, my sweet beloved. I can scarce believe that you plan to take me to Rome, but I am also greatly disturbed by what you have told me, that you have been removed from your post, that you are no longer in sole charge of those who seek out the truth from among those who plot against Rome. Your men seem to have turned against you, even though you are now answerable only to your old friend Pilate the governor. You know that I hung on to you like a child clinging to its mother's breast when you spoke to me of the dangers and the plot against both you and the governor. If I have it right, this conspiracy has been made from the heart of those men who wish ill to the Saviour Jesus. In the midst of all these bad tidings, there was at least the one piece of good news— that the man from Arimathea, Joseph, has pledged his help and assistance, if we require Jesus to be spirited away and hidden for a season or two. The tone of everyone has changed now. The clouds gather, and there is a smell of danger in the air. I had forgotten that I was meant to warn old Saul. My mind is in a great whirl, and in even more confusion, for two of Jesus' closest pupils came to Saul this morning, at dawn, and he has brought them back here. In turn, they will bring the closest of Jesus' followers to us later today, and Jesus with them. They are to use our upstairs room to take a meal here tomorrow night, and possibly the Passover meal on the Sabbath, when we will eat the sacrificed lamb together with unleavened bread. We stand up to eat this, and we wear clothes in which to travel. But I've told you this before. Romulus, a soldier, came to the house tonight, and we did not allow him in. He was not known to me, and he was not an officer. Yet he wore his short sword and walked as though he owned all Jerusalem, and parts of every other city in Judea also. What will happen to us? The word is that the Temple Guard are now accompanied by a small detachment of the Roman garrison. I've made a friend of a girl who sells herself from a house near the Tekoa Gate, mainly to soldiers of the garrison. Her name is Ruth, and she knows of you. She has told me that your men were loyal, but after a sudden change in orders, some of your men asked to go back to ordinary garrison duty like you. Only some of the men have become disaffected, and the word is that the terrorists, who are called Sicarii, assassins, will soon make an uprising. They say there has already been an attempt to kill Pilate. Is this true? He is taken, Romilius. Tonight he stayed with us, he and his pupils, the 12 messengers. They ate in our upper room. We served the food, as Eb and I. Petros was not allowed upstairs, and we were told that we should serve the food and then leave. But I hid just on the stairs outside the door. There was much talking. Then I crept up to the door and looked through the crack. Jesus was solemn once the meal was over. He looked at each of his 12 in turn, exchanged a long look with each of them, then took the bread and tore it into pieces, made a blessing and said, "This is my body which I give for you. Do this in my memory." Each of them took some of the bread and swallowed it and murmured a blessing on themselves. Then Jesus poured a cup of wine, made a blessing and said, "This is my blood, which will be spilled for you. Do this in my memory." And they passed the cup around one to another, each taking a drink of wine and making a blessing prayer for themselves. It was a great and sacred moment, a few seconds that seemed to gather in an entire lifetime. I stood there as though stricken with illness, and one of them then came running for the stairs, and I hid in the shadows and saw him go out. It was the one called Judas, who comes from Kerioth. His face was like a mask, or a clever, frightening carving. Then they all went out, and later we heard that he was taken in the garden, in Gethsemane. The temple guards, together with the soldiers from the garrison, came, a whole crowd of them, with brands and torches that made the light flash and the shadows dance against the walls. Judas showed them the way, and what part of the garden they were in, and he kissed Jesus, and they said that was a sign. What will happen to us now? I send this with Azep. Come to me if you can. Charlie put down the transcript. He sighed, deeply moved by this simple account, though he was yet again somewhat shocked by the descriptions of sex between the girl and the centurion. But he reasoned this was the only way in which the girl Naomi could explain the depth of her feelings for Romilius. She was a relatively simple person, and to her mind, love would be measured by the passion and intensity of the sexual act. He closed his eyes, and there were vivid pictures in his head. The fire from the torches, the words of Jesus. "Do this in my memory." He could see the 12 at the table, unlike any grouping he had seen before. Then Christ with his followers in the garden, and the temple police coming with the Romans, torches held aloft. The smell from the burning torches, and the way the shadows leaped in their fire. Then he could also smell the fear on Naomi. Far away, he thought he could hear the sound of a helicopter descending somewhere near the monastery. Nobody came, so he turned back to what had to be the last entries in Naomi's spoken diary, to the death of Christ and the aftermath. In Glasgow, two plainclothes protection officers, alerted by their colleagues in the anti-terrorist branch, were now on duty, in shifts, at Ward C7 in the Glasgow Royal Infirmary. There was only one way into the room, housing their principal, Hilary Cook, and on their first visit the pair of them went to see her. To begin with, Hilary could not work out why they were there. She thought perhaps it was to ask her questions about the accident, so when she started to talk about it, DC Pete Brooks told her calmly that they were there to protect her. "Oh, to protect me from the mad bloody monk?" she asked. "That must be Charlie Gauntlet's doing. What a sweet man he is." "We're not given all the facts, Miss Cook," Brian Appleby, the other PO, said with a smile. "Though they have told us the threat's high and it comes from one of the Ringmarookie monks, or at least a male in the dress of a Ringmarookie monk."
"You familiar with the monks of Ringmarookie?"
"I wouldn't say familiar, actually, Miss, but I think we can be trusted to identify one on a clear day."
said Pete Brooks. With a following wind, Brian Appleby added.